From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's almost all something we've come to take for granted. Technology, online and otherwise, chipping away at the power of big institutions. Big media, big politics, big corporations, big fish. My guest today says we should slow down for a minute and take a look at what's happening, what's being gained, what's being lost in the rise of the small. This hour on Point, the end of big. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Are you cheering the end of big, running with it? Do you believe it? Does it bother you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Nico Mealy. He was Internet Operations Director for Howard Dean's precedent-setting presidential campaign on that front in 2004, broke new ground in how campaigns harness the power of the net. He's founder of the internet strategy consulting company Echo Ditto, now a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. His new book is The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. Nico Mealy, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
It's great to be here, Tom.
What do you mean the end of big?
Well, our technology has diffused power from big institutions down to individuals in a way that's really challenging our traditional institutions. If you think about it, in 1969, the computers were giant institutional things. A Cray supercomputer cost $5 million and filled an auditorium, and really only the biggest institutions could afford them. Big universities, big companies, the Pentagon. And today, two-thirds of Americans have smartphones that are at least as powerful as a Cray supercomputer. So we've gone in just a few decades from power that was only available to the biggest institutions in the world to everybody carrying them around in their pocket. And that has tremendous implications for all of our traditional institutions.
Is the power of the computer in your back office or in your pocket tantamount to power in the world?
I think at the end of the day, we're seeing that it is. Just last week with everything that happened here in Boston, from the way these bombers trained and learned what to do to people's response
online. Looking up pressure cooker recipes online, maybe being inspired online, communicating.
Meanwhile, when the news was breaking, people turned to Twitter for the most part. They turned to social media. You know, the minute Osama bin Laden was killed, it was a former Pentagon staffer who tweeted it that broke the news. It wasn't a traditional news organization. He just went directly to the internet to say, hey, folks, here's what I'm hearing. That's pretty different from, you know, September 11th when everyone remembers Rudy Giuliani's press conferences on TV, or that iconic moment when the Berlin Wall came down, or even, you know, Woodward and Bernstein breaking the Pentagon Papers.
You got news breaking all over the place, and that's just in the news business where the dynamic has changed. You know, I look at the cover of this book, The End of Big, and what I'm accustomed to, I think many of us are now from the last, 15, 20 years, is a straight-up celebration of this. I mean, the internet was sort of born with this trumpet call, trumpet blast saying, hey, the big, old, heavy, lazy, dull, bad powers, the big ones, are going to come down, and that is just a reason to cheer. But open your book up, and it's kind of a mixed reception you're giving to this.
There's
trend.
Some really great things, and there's some really terrifying ones. A part of the challenge here is that the internet is not we don't even have good language for this. The internet is not a good word for what we're talking about. It doesn't really cover mobile phones. Mm-hmm. In the book, I use the word radical connectivity. We're all radically connected all the time with a certain equal power to it. And the truth is that our institutions haven't been doing a very good job. This is not just a story of technology disrupting institutions. People are opting out of a lot of these institutions using technology because they don't feel well cared for. They don't feel like these institutions have done a good job. That's a very mixed bag.
You mean in politics, you mean in business, you mean in media, mean all over the place.
In big universities, big entertainment. You know, in 1980, the top 10 highest grossing movies of the year, every single one was an original script. In 2012, the top 10 highest grossing movies of the year, every single one was a remake or a sequel. Not a single original story there. people are pretty fed up with the way some of the our big institutions have failed us, and they're opting out. They're going to YouTube. They're going online. They're seeking other kinds of communities. They're seeking other ways of expressing their power. And sometimes that's exciting and exhilarating, and sometimes that's a little scary because we're leaving behind a lot of norms. The institutions of our time, they were built on core values that were hard won, you know, like representative government, deliberation, justice. And when we try and do things outside of these institutions, we haven't really developed online the norms and the process and the expectations. It took a long time for journalism to develop a tradition and ethic of sourcing. And we haven't developed those same kind of norms.
Sourcing, so it wasn't just assertions thrown out there, any willy-nilly thing.
I mean, I think if you look at last week, people were so desperate to be a part of finding these guys, to take a real role in what was happening. People turned to their phones and to Twitter and Facebook and to communities like Reddit to try and participate in the investigation. And that's great. People want to be a part of this. But we did. Our old institutions didn't give them anything to do. There was no way for them to. There wasn't a channel. There wasn't a way to channel all that energy with integrity, and so they ended up misidentifying suspects.
Here, this was on Saturday. This is Lance Ulanoff, who's editor-in-chief of Mashable.com, talking with Tracy Smith of CBS News about how Reddit users made some mistakes in their rush to use the power of the internet to identify the culprits in the Boston Marathon bombings.
Their stated goal was to find the bombers before the FBI. So they weren't necessarily saying, let's help find the bombers. They were like, we're going to beat them to it. We're really good at this. And I think their intentions are really good.
Yes, but we had some misidentification going on. So this is where you're looking to change the narrative here. I mean, the last big noise about this, the end of big, was almost all celebration. And there seemed to be, as you say, a lot of reason to celebrate because we had big institutions that weren't necessarily performing well, that were squeezing people out of power, that were, you know, rolling over little voices. And here was going to come this new age. That excited me. It absolutely excited me. And now here we are 10, 15, 20 years into it, and you're saying, oh, mixed bag.
Well, look at the last hour you just had, right? The carbon tax, the fact that the institutions of our time have not been able to address the climate change issue in any substantial, meaningful way is an absolute and complete failure. And so people are using the internet to opt out and figure out different ways of doing things. The rise of collaborative consumption is really exciting. Car sharing, house sharing, Airbnb, right? At the same time, if you talk to almost any power executive in the country, they'll tell you we have to get away from hub and spoke power generation to distributed power generation. People putting solar power panels on their homes. That's the end of big. That's the exciting and fantastic side. You know, the flip side of it is that we have more Americans self-employed today or employed in small businesses than at any time since the Civil War era. That if you go back to 1820, the vast majority of Americans, the estimate is somewhere around 75%, were farmers or ran their own small shops. In 100 years, by 1920, 87%, that number had flipped to 75% of people employed by large corporations, and it's trending back dramatically in the other direction. People are self-employed. They run small businesses. They're consultants. That means they don't have health insurance. They don't have retirement. They don't have steady incomes. The safety of our big institutions economically is at risk. So on the one hand, we have the return of craft and the way that the rise of our local economies again. You know, a dramatic increase in the number of farmers markets and CSAs in the last 10 years. People really seeking alternative ways, using the internet and radical connectivity to bring efficiencies in, to do things that didn't make sense before, were too expensive or too hard to do. But by the same token, you know, I talk about in my book a couple I interviewed who live in my town who have a business making their own stickers and decals for laptops mm-hmm. that they sell on Etsy and mm-hmm. online. And they work 7 days a week, and they have to be everything. They have to be their own online marketers, their own designers, their own production specialists, they have to source their own supply chain, you know, they do their own budgeting and accounting. It's a mixed bag. There's some very exciting things and some very terrifying things.
The End of Big is Nick O'Mealy's new book, and it's an important book. I mean, you're walking us into this dappled, braided reality of this new century, not just the end of the last century. It was all Hosanna, here we go, freedom, via the web and radical connectivity, as you say. Great, and it is great, but you're saying, look, we got some values on the line here too. Some things big institutions did that are not being supported, though we may value them, but their undergirding is gone.
I mean, think about higher education, right? The cost of a four-year degree in this country has skyrocketed. Its economic earning value has plummeted. I think in some substantial way, higher education is in significant crisis. Mm-hmm. And yet, it's a source of peer-reviewed research, of credible findings, especially in science and the medical field. It's a crucial place for credentialing. You know, I don't know if you'd want to see a surgeon who got a degree online. You know, so on the one hand, the system's failing. On the other hand, it had some pretty important values we got to figure out a way to preserve. And the way we preserve them might not be in the same kinds of institutions as in the past.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how the internet radical connectivity has empowered the small, challenged the power of the big companies, institutions, politics, the press. What's good in that shift and what we may need to watch out for? My guest is Nick O'Mealy. He's author of the new book, The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Nico, do you have some rules that you lay out about where radical connectivity brings improvement, progress, betterment, and where it's bringing trouble? How do you define that terrain a little bit for
well,
us? Could you?
I think what we need to begin to do is to think about our institutions, like have a more compelling conversation about higher education and what's important about it, what we want to keep about it.
Why even make it institution-centric in an era where you say these things, you know, the end of big? So why start with the institutions?
There's still a role for these institutions. They just need to figure out a way to in some cases, they need to redesign themselves to capture the power of radical connectivity, the power out there in the masses. The FBI, instead of asking people to email in photos, should set up a process for helping crowdsourcing and investigations, should channel that energy somewhere compelling. We have a decade of best practices in crowdsourcing in the private sector that we can put to use in a range of other places. Figuring out how our existing institutions can actually take advantage of this dispersed power is a central part of what we need to do. And we have to build some new institutions too. In the case of the AP hack yesterday with Twitter, I think it raises substantial questions about how Twitter thinks about verifying news accounts and the role that I call them in the book, the even bigger. You know, there's essentially six companies that run our online lives: Apple, Amazon, eBay, Google, Facebook, and Microsoft/Skype. Those companies have some greater responsibility here, perhaps, and they're realizing. And we need to begin to have a discussion and imagine what kind of role we want these big platforms for the small to play.
Well, let's test some of these things a little bit here. I mean, the Associated Press hacked tweet yesterday saying that the White House had been bombed. This was false. The president had been injured, or there was word of that. This was false. But, I mean, the markets just swooned as fast as you can snap your fingers. And, of course, they bounced back after the news was corrected. But, wow, talk about a new world here. Here was Maria Bartiromo, CNBC, talking about the reaction to one false hacked tweet.
To have that kind of impact from a 140-character tweet that actually unnerves the entire global system, beginning with the stock market, that's actually quite significant.
CNBC looking at that hacked tweet. Now, let's just begin. Maybe I'm wrong in assuming this is a demonstration of the power of the small. I'm thinking of some, you know, I don't know, anarchic, you know, hacker out there who wants to, I don't know why, who wants to mess with the system and does this, but we don't know that. It could have been somebody playing the market, somebody powerful playing the market.
It's a very end of big moment, I think, and that the it really demonstrates in many ways how fragile a lot of our institutions are. We're like, it's almost, even though, as you said, we're more than a decade into this information revolution, this age of radical connectivity, we're still not really prepared for it. We haven't given it enough thought. We haven't figured out how to react to it and manage it. And meanwhile, people are growing more powerful by the day and figuring out how to use this to their advantage in very good ways and very bad ways. I think, you know, the role of hackers in this is an interesting question. In the chapter I have on big armies, I talk about, you know, national security policy and this notion of cyber war. Mm-hmm. When, you know, when really any sufficiently informed person with a good internet connection and a $500 laptop can wreak havoc on something like the global financial markets, even if it just for 60 seconds, that suggests we're in an age of that we're on really unsteady ground across the board here.
It makes it sound as though your perspective is very attuned to anarchy.
Well, I think that's a risk of what happens here. On the other hand, I have a lot of confidence in our ingenuity and in our desire to build better institutions, to build a better country. There's a lot of exciting things happening that are worth encouraging.
You encourage us to think about the structure of the web, the internet, radical connectivity as we experience itself. You say it's not by accident. It was built by people who shared a certain view of the world, a certain mindset, and to a certain end, to a certain purpose.
Sure, a lot of the nerds who built our modern digital age were on college campuses in the 60s, in the early 70s, and they were experiencing, you know, the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, and they had the sense that our institutions had taken us down a tremendously wrong path here. And the fact that they saw this incredible power of the computer as an institutional power, that worried them. And there's a book by a guy named Ted Nelson called You Can and Must Understand Computers Now, Computer Lib, where he was part of a movement to call for the personal computer, which in the late 60s and early 70s was a radical notion that a computer which would fill an auditorium would be a personal device and give power to the people, that it would be a way to hold institutions accountable. That was a radical notion, but it was picked up by people like Steve Jobs, you know, the famous commercial for introducing the Macintosh in 1984.
Throwing the sledgehammer through the 1984
right.
face, and in the structure of the net, the web itself, there was political intent.
Absolutely. I think that there was it's very hard to untangle the natural direction and development of the technology from the cultural era and history and moment that those pioneers came out of. But they definitely saw this as a powerful device. And I think that some of them thought, I interviewed in the book, Mitch Kapor founded Lotus, mm-hmm. and he talked about how he said, I think we just misunderstood the speed with which both the speed with which the technology would move and the speed with which institutions would catch up, because I'm not sure they have caught up.
You know, there must have been assumptions about human nature embedded in this. You tear down the big power. That was clearly a goal here. There were assumptions about how the small power would act.
Sure. Well, Craig of Craigslist says that the fundamental animating notion of Craigslist is that people are good. And I think that can work pretty well, but there's some people who aren't good.
We've got a real-time experiment unfolding here.
Yeah.
What have we learned to this point about that? If that's the presumption, you're going to spread power all over the place, and people are good, so they'll exercise it in a good way, is that a flawed notion? And if it is, what does that mean? And I mean, you're projecting some really scary scenarios looking forward here.
I don't think it's entirely a flawed notion. As scary as it is, the opportunity is just as great. We just have to seize it. We have to decide that that's where we're going to drive this. You know, think about the very way government works, the nature of representative democracy. I mean, we vote on Tuesdays because Sunday is church day and Monday is market day, and you ride your horse and buggy into town to vote on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, we have 435 members of the House of Representatives. More or less, because that's how many fit in the room.
The building. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure any of those assumptions really make sense anymore. Thomas Jefferson said we should rewrite the Constitution every few decades. And I think it's time for like a fundamental reimagining of what's possible with government, with society, given the distributed power of our internet phones, radical connectivity.
Nico Mealy is looking at where that distributed power is running these days, and it's a complicated map. His book is The End of Big. He's with me in the studio. Nico, let's bring in our callers. Adam in Nashville, Tennessee. Adam, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to go back a bit and comment on the topic of news and how news has changed with the advent of social media. I closely followed the Boston Marathon bombings, both through Reddit and through more traditional news sources like NPR and some of the cable networks. Mm-hmm. And what I found, your guest does mention that, yes, Reddit and Twitter and social media got things wrong. The thing is, when they did get things wrong, people were almost immediately corrected on them. You don't see that with the cable media sources, you know, in the sense that when CNN or MSNBC picks up a topic, they tend to just run with it and pick up the pieces later, if there is any accountability for it at all. With a discussion on Reddit, you'll have somebody who says, you know, oh, this guy's probably the bomber. A few people may pick that up. Somebody else says, no, that's, you know, it may even be the person saying, no, this wasn't me, obviously. Here's my proof. And with, you know, with so many reports of various bombs and terrorists and who knows what, flying around the whole thing, it was nice to have a source where people on the ground would be able to provide proof that things either were or were not as others said they were.
Adam, I know what you mean. Nick, you're nodding your head at Nico as well here. Kind of a self-correcting dynamic when big institutions may be too proud to correct that quickly. On the other hand, where's the ultimate accountability? I don't know.
Or big institutions haven't, for the most part, set up the mechanisms to correct that quickly, or to use their audiences to help them correct that
quickly.
Because
their reporter who was leaked this information is on air talking about it while it may be disproved under his feet, but he doesn't know.
That's right, and they're reluctant to give any power to their audience to help shape their own coverage for the most part. I mean, I think it's a good point that the social media was an essential part of last week and carried a lot of exceptionally powerful and compelling moments. You know, I live right here in Boston, and the ability to go on Facebook or Twitter and tell my friends and families and colleagues all over the world I was safe was and my family was safe was essential and very comforting. The ability to follow the breaking news. I mean, the first thing I did was start following what was happening on Twitter, because I obviously follow a lot of Bostonians. And so there's no doubt that social media played an essential and valuable role. And one of the most amazing things about last week is how it put in such high relief how poorly some of our traditional institutions are up to the task, but also how underdeveloped the web and radical connectivity that these communities are, that they don't have norms or process or ways of managing mm-hmm. this with integrity.
It's still in flux. Susan in Tell City, Indiana. Susan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment. I'm all about small business and small companies making it, but I don't necessarily think that the end of big is a good thing. And I am a 37-year-old college student, and we are told to use the internet, but I would say that there are a lot of sources that we're also steered away from because they are not reliable, and there are no checks and balances with the readily available information that's out there, and you've talked about that on air already. How do you know in this society where we believe that when we see something on air or in the media, we believe it to be fact-checked and correct, how do you believe or know what to believe when you read it or see it on the internet? That's one problem that I've ran into.
Yeah, Susan, it's a good question. I appreciate your raising it. How about it, Nico? That's sort of feeling at sea.
Well, this gets back to that we need to figure out some new ways of doing this. One example of a place that does it pretty well is Wikipedia, right? Wikipedia has a 15-year history of figuring out culture and norms and rules, even though they really say they the only rules, there are no rules. There's still process to try and bring integrity to the source of information on Wikipedia, and it is, by and large, pretty successful. And when we look at other online communities, I think it's time for us to have some discussion and some greater thoughtfulness about ways that other online communities can begin to create some of that process and culture to bring about some of the same values.
Of course, some of those institutions, you look at news, their economic foundation is undermined by the new fluid radical connectivity, even though they may still have a role to play, even though it's played not flawlessly, but there's no guarantee that we're going to have this kind of juxtaposition, this equipoise of the new and the old here with the tempering influence one on the other forever. Old big can just go away.
Yeah, well, we're seeing that with the newspapers. And the scary part about that is that the vast majority of the investigative reporting of holding power accountable in this country is done by newspapers. And so as newspapers struggle with both the business model of newspapers, advertising and subscriptions has been completely undone by the digital age and is not going to get put back together. And so the question there is, I'm not going to defend newspapers, but we got to build some other vehicles, some other institutions for investigative journalism, for holding power accountable in a way that's professional, that has standards, that has norms, that has ways of bringing integrity to reporting.
You can feel people's ambivalence here. The connectivity feels so empowering and exciting. At the same time, a listener writes to us, why is it always the size that we talk about and never about the efficiency of the institution, the proficiency, the policy, the professionality, the expertise, the sound reason? I mean, I don't know if you agree or not with that list, but yes, they have been vessels of certain values, imperfectly and not always, but that's been there.
Sure. You know, I love talking about this, obviously, but when I think about political parties, you know, political parties used to be real grassroots organizations, and they identified talent and they brought talent up the ranks. And they actually tried to cultivate a sense of public service. There was plenty of backroom cigar chomping and favor trading and all the normal excitement and misery of politics. But there was also a real grassroots network to identify leaders and prime them, prepare them for public service. But somewhere along the lines in the last 35 or 40 years, they became really vehicles for fundraising for major donors, and that's it. And that's why when the internet comes along and gives another a way of raising money mm-hmm. outside of the party infrastructure, suddenly candidates are competitive because the parties had atrophied enough that it was pretty easy to puncture that with online fundraising.
You give us a really dappled picture. There again, problem with the institution. Some kind of answer in the radical connectivity in the internet and all of its arms. But you also warn in here about demagoguery, about how this can be manipulated. Even though you've got dispersed power, it can be played.
Sure, sure. The power of the individual also speaks to the power of leadership in the context of the radical connectivity. You know, I firmly believe that the leaders of the next 100 years are going to be the ones who understand how to harness this distributed power of individuals, this army of Davids, and use it to their advantage. And we need to build ways of holding them accountable and ways of encouraging them serving in public service.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about how the internet has empowered the small, challenged the power of the big, companies, institutions, politics, the press, what's good in that shift, and what we will need to watch out for. My guest is Nico Mealy. He's author of The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath, and it is a very subtle and challenging view of the world, the century that we are moving into right now, and the implications, both the kind of utopian vision that the internet came with, but also a keen sense of the complexity that distributed power is also creating around us for good and ill. Nico, I've got questions here, but a couple of things first from listeners. Yar writes to us first. People aren't so sure that the big is out of power here. I mean, you mentioned the big six, Google and Facebook and so on, but here's Hefei says, the end of big, are you kidding me? He must have looked at your picture online. He says, does the author realize those glasses he's wearing are possibly made by one corporation? And he says here, Luxottica, Italian eyewear manufacturer, owns nearly every recognizable brand of eyewear in the world. Ray-Ban, Oakley, Kolsch, Prada, right on. And the sellers of those, Lens Crafters, Pearle Vision, Sunglasses. I don't know about this, but here's our, you know, we're crowdsourcing here. This is what Hefei says. Never mind just big media, even eyeglasses. You've got huge companies. And then Yar writes to us, says, wait a minute, big data. It rules, it profiles everything. We know more about you than you know about yourself. I bet we could even tell who manipulated the market with those false tweets. There's not this certainty that big is over, that it may be bigger than ever.
Let me take the eyeglasses on first. In fact, there's absolutely an end of big story about eyewear. Warby Parker is an internet startup that decided to take on the big conglomerate in eyewear manufacturing, essentially using the internet to bring down costs and be competitive. The founder is also doing it in shaving cream to try and take on Procter & Gamble.
But how well did they do if they still own Ray-Ban, Oakley, Coach, and Pearle Vision and Lens Crafters? Again,
we're at the beginning of the end of big in manufacturing and business. Mm-hmm. And when we get to an age of 3D printers, which is coming, I bought a 3D printer for about $1,500.
That is to sort of manufacture or whatever you want.
It sprays plastic. I printed my own iPhone case. I'm trying.
Can printing I hold that?
Yeah, I'm printing shoes for my boys.
This iPhone case. This didn't exist. You turned on your printer. And said,
I downloaded a design from the internet. It sprayed the plastic into that shape. And not only that, it's compostable and recyclable.
And this is just an iPhone holder.
Shoes, eyewear. We're trying
to regulate guns.
We're at the very beginning of a coming massive sea change in industrial manufacturing because of the power of what they call on-demand fabrication and 3D printers. The 3D printer I have is relatively primitive. It was $1,500, but guess what? That's what a laser printer cost 15 years ago. That's what a microwave oven cost 35 years ago, and now there's one in just about every American home.
So, honey, I'll be with you in a minute. I'm making an assault rifle in the basement.
In fact, there's a guy in Texas who has been printing assault weapons, semi-automatic pieces for semi-automatic weapons on his 3D printer to prove how absolutely how he can get around just about any regulation that you might want to pass.
You talk about distribution of power, and yet, there is a sense that while the initial view was this is going to move power all over the place, at the same time, the web itself is being used to consolidate power in some circumstances. And Yar looks at big data and says, come on, when we are this well known by those with gigantic computer power, that's concentration. That's not diffusion.
Sure. Well, the first chapter of the book talks about the history of computing, and then the last chapter of the book talks about the future of it, about these even bigger and their role with big data. It's absolutely something we got to be talking about. In many ways, I think that the big companies of the internet have as much, if not more, power than governments. In some sense, we've lost track of how much power they've got. They've kind of slipped in under the radar here. And we need to figure out ways to better vehicles to hold them accountable. There was a story circulating online last week about a guy whose Gmail account got deleted because Google decided they wanted to do that, and how hard it was for him to have any kind of recourse, how hard it was for him to appeal that decision in any way, shape, or form.
The very framework of our lives. Let's go to Los Angeles, California. Freddie's calling. Hi, Freddie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've listened to the conversation. I'd really like to know what Thomas Friedman would say about this book. I don't see the big companies getting any smaller. If anything, I see a more level playing field for the smaller companies. But I think of a news company like NPR. NPR harnesses the internet across, coast to coast. I'm in L.A. I'm listening to you in Boston.
Yep.
You know, and I see the strength of the internet making companies that can harness it and see the opportunity making it bigger. I don't see how this is making anything smaller.
It can magnify the small, but it can magnify the big.
Well,
it's a great point, Freddie.
Think about NPR. It's driven, by, for the most part, by local affiliates. It really is much more of a small story. Or, you know, David Weinberger describes the internet as small pieces loosely joined. And I think that's a way you could understand NPR and successful institutions of the future.
But this is traditionally the case, and NPR is very devoted to this kind of distributed power. But here's Freddie, and it sounds to me like he's listening online, you know, with or without the local affiliate. And so you've got the other thing happening at the same time.
Yeah, the disruption of the institutions. There's no doubt that I still don't believe it's making anything bigger except for a handful of what I think of as platform internet companies that the small is built on.
Boy,
The direction and force of our technology is completely towards empowering the individual.
Yes,
and
but
that
it does
come at the
allow,
expense of institutions.
Well, but it allows big central powers to reach also over the shoulder of locals and get into their backyard. Look at businesses where you can do things centrally that once, I don't know, the local rep was the one you dealt with. Now, you know, via a software program and a call center, you're dealing with the central rep.
I do think a central question about the end of big in jobs, in companies, in manufacturing is how many jobs are we actually going to have at the end of the day here?
Connor in Taunton, Massachusetts. Freddie in L.A., thanks for your call. Connor, you're on.
How you doing, Tom?
Okay.
I just wanted to bring up a point that's been it's actually a story that's been circulating in the media lately about Bitcoin, which is a untraceable currency that is used on black market websites.
Sure, Bitcoin, digital money.
Yes. I just wanted to ask, how does it reflect on the institutions, even legal institutions, when people can buy guns, drugs, basically anything they want off a website from their home?
Sure. When even currency isn't a common currency. You got Bitcoin doing its own thing. How about it?
I actually talk in the book at some length about Bitcoin and the online black market called the Silk Road. It's kind of a fascinating story that the U.S. Navy created something called Tor, T-O-R, to protect democracy activists in unfriendly regimes by anonymizing their internet activity.
Right.
So if you're a pro-democracy activist in Syria and you want to avoid detection by the government, you could download Tor, designed by the U.S. Navy.
And the dictator can't tell who you are.
That's right. Well, guess who else loves this? It's been very successful for pro-democracy activists.
Yeah.
And really, really a lot of evidence it's helped and even saved lives. But criminals love this. Child pornographers love this. It's also
it.
A way to
– And they can get it?
And they can get it, and anybody can go get it. And then you can purchase things and do economic transactions on a site called the Silk Road on Tor, which really resembles Amazon with user rating reviews and what have you, using bitcoins to pay for it.
Wow.
And it's a perfect example of the incredible good about protecting these pro-democracy activists and helping them navigate inside these repressive regimes, but at the same time opening up another can of worms on the other side.
Get ready for some kind of century. I mean, get your surfboards out. We got waves going in all directions here. Richard in Enid, Oklahoma. Richard, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. I'm enjoying y'all's conversation, and the thought process that I have, it kind of takes us back to the cooperative type of society. You take farmers back in the day, and co-ops that even exist today as well. We're looking at individuals looking for being represented and being able to do their own thing, and the co-op, as long as they do that, will survive. If it doesn't, it will kind of peter out, and the individual will seek another source to represent them. So I'd like y'all's comments with respect to that analogy with what's going on in y'all's discussion.
You're saying, Richard, that, for example, farmers cooperating in a co-op, they have the choice individually to act together in a way that benefits all of them, but they could walk away from that.
That's correct. As long as the co-op represents them properly, it will continue to exist, and if it doesn't, it will disappear, and people will find another way.
I see that's
what's going on as a whole.
Yeah, that's terrific. I'm glad you raised it, Richard. I mean, Nico, this describes the kind of world I grew up in. Small farmers doing a lot of things together, cooperatively, and reaping a lot of benefit for that in a way that people all over the web can do today. But there was also a framework around that of, you know, institutional co-ops who tried to develop systems to optimize, to help farmers optimize that cooperation and who serviced those cooperative efforts. But Rich is making the point that there's a kind of democracy here. If the institutions function, great. People are probably going to sign up. If they don't these days, they can sure walk away.
The co-op is a fascinating model, and I'm feeling, you know, like I missed out. I didn't include it in the book. It would have been great. But I think that's absolutely part of what's happening here. I believe that over the next couple of decades, we'll develop the models for the digital future that will, in many cases, resemble this kind of co-op. It'll be voluntary. It'll be participatory. But it will also have process and rules mm-hmm. that bring safety and integrity and whatever other values we want to bring to it. The question is, in the interim, while the big institutions are not plugged into this and the norms and institutions of the digital age haven't fully developed, what are we going to do? How do we avoid some disastrous outcome?
Let's get Peter in Stamford, Connecticut on. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Hi, Miko.
Hi.
I was wondering about, did you have a chapter on organized religion? Now I'm thinking of fraternal organizations, worldwide religion. You know, I'm in a small church, a lot of churches mainline Christian churches are struggling. I'm wondering if you had that as a chapter in your book.
I mean, there's a lot here. Big companies, big minds, big armies, big fun, big political parties. Do you get all the way down to philosophies? Because those can be fractured, too, and maybe the institutions around them.
That's a good question. There are actually two bigs I left out of the book. One is big banks, which I do mention in the context of Bitcoin and government, but it could have made a fascinating chapter with community banks and credit mm-hmm. unions. It's mm-hmm. fascinating stuff. And the other one is big church, big religion. And the reason I left those two out is the story is not as clear-cut technologically, right? That in both big banks and big religion, I think you see some of the same trends of the institutions failing or not doing the job they were meant to do. But at the same time, there was not as much direct individual activity harnessing the technology to build alternatives, to figure out ways of opting out. And so I don't know if the caller has the technological story there, the social media angle on the end of big church. That would be pretty, pretty interesting. You can tweet it at me.
It's interesting how – what's your Twitter handle?
Nico, N-I-C-C-O.
Okay. It's interesting how the technology here – it can inspire changes in how we see the world, but the way we see the world can also kind of drive the technology. The atomization of religious communities may have begun even before the web. Our time grows short. You've got some intimidating prospects you describe in here. You say 10 years from now, we might well find ourselves living in constant fear of extremist groups and lone individuals who, thanks to technology, can disrupt society at will, shutting off power, threatening food supplies, creating mayhem in the streets, and impeding commercial activity. That sounds pretty lousy. Then you say, this is just the beginning, what we're looking at here. Can you imagine daily life without currency issued by the national government? Distinctly possible. Hyper-local society, no sanitation department to come get your trash. Government bodies, don't regulate business anymore because of the end of big. Can you trust your food, your medicines, your automobiles? And how will we solve big problems like hunger and global warming? I mean, this is a very imposing sort of picture you're painting. Where do you go with this? Do we have to revamp the big? Do we have to restructure the small?
Both. I feel a great deal of urgency about the moment we're in historically. And the last chapter, I compare it to 1910. You know, in 1910, they were at King Edward VII's funeral. Every country in the world is represented, and they were almost all monarchies and colonies. There were three democracies, France, Switzerland, and the United States. And a century later, that world is gone, unrecognizable, does not exist. And I feel like we're at a similar historical moment, that our institutions are plodding along like this is the way it's going to be for the next 100 years. And I don't see it playing out that way. And that gives me a great sense of urgency and like we need to figure this out. And I'm optimistic and hopeful. We're ingenious people, you know, the humans and especially here in the United States, That's a core part of our culture. We can do this. The fact that the framers of the Constitution, they really had only ever experienced hereditary monarchy, and they managed to design the United States, is exceptional. And we're at a similar moment, and it calls for similar kinds of imagination and leadership on part of all of us.
You're telling us with all the change and sometimes chaos we feel like we're experiencing now, we may be actually look back and think this was the Belle Epoque?
Well, I think that there is this is a fragile time. I think that, you know, when you were reading that description a moment ago from my book,
Lone Wolves,
that sounded like the last 10 days in Boston to me.
Yes,
right?
It did.
And so I'm confident that if we don't really give this some attention and a moral vision, that we're going to end up in some dangerous places. But I'm also confident we can do this. We're up to the task.
Who's we, Kimo Sabe? If it's not the big, you know, is it Congress? Is it it's not the FCC? Who's the we?
I think it's everybody, but it's most especially those of us existing within some of these institutions, but also people who are opting out of them. I think it's equal parts. It's equal parts. The big institutions in the book, I identify some things I think big institutions could do, and it's the institutions of the future that we all have to build.
We have radical connectivity now. It sounds in this view like we had better use it to figure this out. Nicole Mealy has written the important book. It's called The End of Big, How the Internet Makes David the New Goliath. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Nico, thank you very much for being with us today. So great to have you come in. You've opened our eyes. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks to all the callers, too.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Follow me on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us today. This is On Point.